Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Very few people have experienced life on Antarctica, but a Michigan-born director spent a full year on the continent. On today's show, a conversation about his new film, No Horizon Anymore, a year-long journey to the South Pole. And then later in the hour, a history lesson, the history of UFOs in Michigan. But first to another thing that is history, the primary election of 2013. Now the focus shifts to the November general election. And for the two candidates who want to become Detroit's next mayor, it's time to take stock of the harsh realities facing the city and craft a clear campaign message that addresses those stark truths. My next guest has been issuing that challenge from the pages of the Detroit Free Press all through the campaign. And now that the two challengers have emerged from the primary, we wanted to get his thoughts. So we're joined by the editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press, Stephen Henderson. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Well, your editorial in last Sunday's Free Press was written before Mike Duggan and Benny Napoleon won the top two slots. And we'll get your thoughts on the pros and cons of each candidate in a moment. But first, that editorial that fiction got Detroit here and only facts can save it. It struck me as I read it a couple of times, that you were really expressing a hefty amount of frustration in your piece.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. I think the if you look at the field that we had to choose from, in this mayoral contest, it left a lot to be desired. I mean, here we are at certainly the lowest financial point in the city's history. Among, I think it was 18 candidates total, you had two really who were even relatively serious in the sense that you could take them seriously. That's not good enough. We should have had many more choices. We should have had many more competent choices. The fact that we didn't is testament, I think, to the circumstances that led us here in the first place.
Meaning what? Why weren't there more? Because I did hear that sentiment expressed elsewhere too. That you looked at the slate and you kind of went, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's the polite response to looking at the field. I mean, I think this is a long-running problem in Detroit, frankly, and there are a lot of reasons for it. One is the number of people who actually live in the city and they're therefore qualified to run for mayor is diminished quite a bit. That shrinks the pool of qualified candidates. You sort of add to that the job itself. By any measure, it's thankless.
Very much.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to be an easy job. I think when we saw Dave Bing, a former sports star and businessman run for the job 4 years ago, I think that inspired a lot of people that with the idea that perhaps we could attract a higher caliber of candidate to that race, but his 4-year performance, which has left a lot to be desired, I think also dampened some of that enthusiasm. And so we really just are not in a place yet where we are seeing the kind of people who we should be able to choose from throw their hat in the ring to say, hey, I want to be mayor of Detroit.
I'm speaking with Stephen Henderson, editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press. And now let's look at the two mayoral candidates. Stephen, give us your take on the strengths and weaknesses of Mike Duggan.
Well, I think his strength is really the professional record that he's put together. I mean, this is somebody who has been a success everywhere that he's worked, in Wayne County, as the deputy county executive, and then as the prosecutor of Wayne County, and then as the CEO of the Detroit Medical Center. He can point to something that he did in each of those roles that shows, hey, I did that. I not only had that job, but I got something done in it. I think on the con side, first is his association with a time in Wayne County government when there was naked and obvious corruption. His role in that was never really vetted because the investigations crumbled when former Wayne County executive Ed McNamara died, but I don't think there was any question that there was certainly a culture of cronyism that he was part of there.
That is something would be very, very bad. We've seen what happened with the Kirkpatrick administration.
Sure, so, and would not be tolerated. I mean, I think that's one of the other wrinkles there, is that we have a very different U.S. attorney in Detroit now that I don't think would stand for a lot of the things that have gone on here over a long period of time. His other big drawback, and this is something that we're just starting to really see in this campaign, is I think his view of the mayoral position is something of a throwback. I mean, Mike Duggan is someone who believes that consolidating power in one person's hands is the way to run a city, and he will be able to bring results and success to city government just by virtue of his own leadership and being in control. I said in my column that I said in my column Tuesday that it's sort of a Richard J. Daley view of the job. I think that's very dangerous. I think it's not realistic in the current era of government.
But isn't that what he did at DMC?
It is some of what he did at DMC, although I've always thought that he never gave enough credit at DMC to the tremendous help he got from the state. I mean, he got tremendous financial help from the state to turn that place around. But there's no question that his management style is such that he can turn things around. He can make places better and deliver results. I think city government is a very different place even than a medical center, and the problems that he would face would really challenge that model of leadership in a way that worries me. If he were to win.
And of Benny Napoleon.
Benny Napoleon's greatest strength, I think, is his long, long, long commitment to this city. I mean, he's a lifelong Detroiter, has served in any number of different leadership positions around town. His own campaign commercials play that up very strongly. I think his weaknesses are sort of detailed in his record in those jobs. As Detroit police chief, I can't seriously say that he was successful. I mean, crime did not really go down very much when he was chief, and we had some other problems that led to federal intervention in the police department.
Yeah.
As sheriff, he's overspent his budget consistently. And so I think that's his challenge, to show that he's going to be different as mayor than he has in these other jobs.
When I spoke with both candidates yesterday, they both made a point, and I want to get your thoughts on this. Did the media spend too much time and ink on distractions like Mike the Barber to the detriment of covering serious, real candidates?
Well, I mean, I think the candidates each got plenty of ink during the campaign. I think those distractions were interesting because they were anomalous. And think about news coverage. News coverage is generally not about the mundane or the normal. It's about, the thing that stands out. We had a lot of anomalies during this campaign. We had a write-in candidate, a very serious write-in candidate mounting a very serious campaign. That's unheard of in big city politics. We had a white candidate doing that. That's unheard of, really, in Detroit politics. And so I think that did aid to some distraction. But I also would say, you didn't see the major candidates, laying out detailed plans either to compete with that narrative. I think both of them were fairly content to stick to broad talking points, thinking that voters wouldn't look too closely and that they'd squeak through the primary to the general. I'm hoping that in the general, because there will just be two of them, because there won't be the distraction of the write-in, we can get down to a little more substance.
Although Mike Duggan said to us, anyone who went to one of his 185 coffee meetings did hear specifics. He felt, I wouldn't have gotten where I did if I wasn't giving people specifics.
Well, I was at one of those where I just showed up. He didn't know I was going to be there, but I wanted to hear what he was saying in these forums. And there's no question, he was very specific about his track record in those in those talks. He was not as specific about how he would change the city of Detroit, how he would improve government, other than to say, I'm Mike Duggan, and I do things differently. And I think that's a very powerful message if you are Mike Duggan and you have that track record. But we heard that same pitch from Dave Bing, who turned out not to be successful. And so I think there's some skepticism about how will he do that and how successful can he be given the rampant dysfunction in city government, given the lack of capacity to make change. I mean, the people that you need around you to do things better aren't here in Detroit. And so he's got to be more specific about how he will meet those challenges.
Stephen Henderson, editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press. We'll catch you on that Sunday editorial page.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, Stephen.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, the results of Tuesday's primary in Detroit in terms of write-in votes have to be certified by the Wayne County Board of Canvassers. So right now, they are plowing their way through the more than 50,000 write-in votes. The Detroit Election Commission reports that Mike Duggan, D-U-G-G-A-N, that name got more than 44,000 votes. But there are many different versions of that name to be certified. Mick Duggan, Mick Duggar, Goggin, Dockery, Dugmond. And we should note, write-in votes went to Mickey Mouse, Goofy, LL Cool J, and last but most certainly not least, Jesus Christ. It will take about 2 weeks for the Board of Canvassers to certify all those write-in votes. Still to come, are there enough skilled workers in Michigan to meet post-Great Recession job demands? The answer isn't so clear. We'll find out why in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. For 1 week in March of 1966, Michigan was awash with reports of UFO sightings. Scores of people called police to report suspicious items in the sky. Ultimately, the Air Force dismissed the sightings as nothing more than swamp gas, causing then-Congressman Gerald Ford to fire off an indignant statement declaring people deserved a better explanation than something as laughable as swamp gas. Dr. Rudy Linder is a professor of history and astronomy at the University of Michigan. He teaches a class called Discovery of the Universe that includes the history of UFOs, and he joins us here in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for asking me.
How has Michigan figured into the history of UFO sightings as compared to other states? Have we had more or fewer?
Michigan, I would say, is about average. One of the difficulties is that Michigan is the second cloudiest state in the Union. Mm-hmm. So therefore, there is a selection effect that goes into all of this. There's also a problem that with a couple of large metropolitan areas, people don't look up to the sky very much because, quite frankly, sometimes it's even hard to see the moon.
Yes.
There, I can say that Michigan has far fewer of these sightings, at least historically, mm-hmm. than does the state of Ohio. Ohio seems, again, there are no really mm-hmm. wonderful statistics on this. Ohio seems to be the leader in such reports. And quite frankly, for example, the first report in which there was a mysterious death that was attributed perhaps to alien action was in Ohio very, very early on in the late 40s, early 50s. For anybody who was associated with the University of Michigan, it is, of course, a little bit easier to accept the notion that aliens might have some special relationship with the state of Ohio and its people.
So there you go. If you will, take us back that week in March of 1966. And I was living in Oakland County. I remember things in the paper, news reports about UFOs and mystery sightings in the sky. And we were outside every night watching for UFOs. What do you feel was behind all of that? And was there ever an attempt to get a better explanation than that swamp gas explanation?
Well, the swamper or marsh gas explanation was one that was just casually mentioned by one of the scientists. And he noted later that his heart leapt when he saw the reporters scribbling down the words marsh gas and running off to the telephones And that was the end of it. And he felt that he never lived that down. They did consult a couple of astronomers at the University of Michigan, some of whom were very – we have a pretty good department, mm-hmm. had a very good department. And one of them, William Beidelman, whom I knew by accident, spent some time looking it over, and he decided that the evidence was not such that one could reach any conclusion. Part of the problem with UFOs is, of course, that these are anomalous occurrences. There are no observatories that spend their time looking for anomalous things. The people who see these, leaving aside frauds, and the Dexter Hillsdale case of 1966 was not a fraud, the cases of which you've been speaking. But it did seem that these people were – they described what they saw. They seemed to be reasonably congruent, the various mm-hmm. things that they said. But the difficulty was that, of course, they were not trained observers. They were not trained scientists. One of the great difficulties you have is in figuring out the speed or the size of an object when you have no good way of measuring its distance. And that has always been the bane of reports of UFOs, that you, unless you have some way of having a good idea of the distance, your notion of the speed or your notion of the size simply isn't there. The Hillsdale-Dexter case became very important because shortly thereafter, a man called Gray Barker, who lived in Clarksburg, West Virginia, published a book called Flying Saucers Are Watching You. And it was a study of this particular week-long series, including a composite drawing of the UFO that was built up on the basis of testimony.
Okay.
The difficulty with that is that Barker was associated with another great Michigan UFO business from the 50s. And this all became part of a book that he wrote called They Knew Too Much, which is about this notion that the UFOs, be they friend, be they foe, it is possible that we're not ready.
Oh, okay.
It's like Sherlock Holmes, the adventure of the great giant rat of Sumatra, a story for which the world is not yet prepared. And the cute thing about this is that Barker's book, They Knew Too Much, mm-hmm. is in fact the book that was the basis for the movie Men in Black.
That's great. And that's true. They were there to protect us from that realization that there were other civilizations. And a U of M graduate played a part in this. Tell us about Morris Jessup.
Morris Jessup is a fascinating guy. He got an engineering degree from Michigan at a time when a lot of engineers took an astronomy course. He and another engineer, the university hired them to take part in an astronomical expedition to South Africa that was supposed to take about 3 years to observe a particular class of objects. The observatory actually was there from 1925 until the 1970s, did quite a lot of useful work. Jessup was there for 3 years. He made some interesting discoveries, came back, became a graduate student in the astronomy department briefly, then there was always something about him. He went off, taught for a year at Drake University, and then disappeared from sight. He came back. He appears again in the 1950s because he wrote a book called The Case for the UFO, which sold very well in paperback. I remember I bought a copy in the local drugstore in Stockton, California for 25 cents. There are still copies around. It's a book that has a great deal of charm. And it's Jessup's collection of stories about very peculiar incidents which he believed involved UFOs. And he finally decided that these are alien. The UFOs are piloted by alien beings. He suggested a location for them, for their base behind the moon. And he wrote two more books. And he became one of these sort of great UFO mavens. He would appear on television. In 1959, he died under mysterious circumstances in Miami, Florida. And there were questions about, for instance, whether he had died by his own hand, whether he had died by natural causes, whether he had been killed by the agencies of the federal government to shut him up. And this man, Gray Barker in Clarksburg, wrote a book about Jessup. Again, it's a book of great charm and not much else. But Barker went a step further. Barker held seances. And in a number of these seances, Jessup appeared, announced that he was not dead. He had been abducted by aliens. He was now living on the planet Venus, was very happy, and really didn't want to say a lot more. And quite frankly, what I say, what is of interest to a Michigan audience, is that as a Michigan graduate, you know, we not only have hundreds of thousands of Michigan graduates, members of the Alumni Association, but we also have, you know, we have alumni who have a little group in Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia, but we also have an alumnus doing rather well on the planet Venus. And I say, take that, Harvard.
Take that, Harvard. I'm speaking with Dr. Rudy Linder, who is a professor of history and astronomy at the University of Michigan, and he teaches a class called Discovery of the Universe. And we're talking about the history of UFOs. When did UFO sightings first start? If you were to kind of do a graph as far as frequency of reports, when did we first have people going, there's something in the sky, and I think it's something from another planet?
In the Hebrew Bible.
Oh, okay.
However, there have been occasional waves. There was a wave in the 1880s. There was a little bit of a wave in World War II because of some things that fighter pilots saw. But really, it all began in 1947, again with the rise of the Cold War, mm-hmm. people being uncertain about what American technology was doing, whether we had special weapons, whether the Russians had special weapons.
Right.
And when it began in 47 and grew in 48, and you had people in airliners and pilots and people seeing them, a certain amount of fraud, much of which was very ingenious. We have early contactees in the early 1950s, so that now, according to the research of John Mack at the Harvard Medical School, about 1 in 3,000 Americans, according to his projections, claims to have been abducted by aliens. This means that the next time that there's a big game in the Michigan Stadium, and of course all of them are big games in the Great Michigan Stadium, which seats about 109,000 people, there will be 33 people, who knows, one sitting next to you, who claims to have been abducted by aliens. Now, the important point about that is that that is, in fact, an undercounting. I'm sure that if you've ever come across somebody who claimed to have been abducted by aliens, you may have found them a little bit different in some ways. And there's a reason for that, and the reason for the undercounting is the same reason. We only see the ones whom they throw back.
The good ones they keep.
And the ones who would make, you know, the most sense, of course, are the ones whom they keep. So it's something to bear in mind. The 66 flap, yes, as it's called, is one of the last of the great
sighting waves.
Of the great sighting waves.
Well, and we were right in the middle of the Gemini program at the time. So space travel was on our minds. We had come out of the 50s with all the cheesy science fiction movies. And some that are not so cheesy. The Day the Earth Stood Still comes to mind. So we were in the middle of kind of that space fever. And here we are now in 2013. And is it safe to say interest in space exploration is not what it was? We're not even sending rockets up now as far as manned rockets and manned flights. So is that why we're seeing fewer reports today?
I honestly don't know. I do think that these things do come. They ebb and they flow. Notice that in recent years, astronomers have discovered more and more of what they call exoplanets. That is to say, fairly large planets or planet-like objects that orbit around other stars. And, you know, all it needs is for there to be one bit of evidence that, for example, there is, and this evidence probably will come before too long, thanks to increasing technological proficiency, that there are Earth-type planets orbiting around distant or fairly nearby. And there's always the hope, you know, that we will get some contact with people. There are certainly groups that are searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. And after all, we're broadcasting to the universe. In our neighborhood now, people are listening, or I should say our cousins, shall we say, and not too far away, are listening now to The Lucy Show. They're watching Lassie and wondering which is the intelligent being. And before too long, they're going to get talk radio. Hmm. Now, that might keep them away. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if there were more of these things. Notice also as well that there has been a tendency, I think one of the failures of my generation is that we haven't done such a good job, or at least I certainly haven't done a good job, in teaching people what is scientific and what is not. Mm. And one of the reasons I talk about flying saucers is so that the students have some sense of what a scientific argument is and what a non-scientific argument is. And sometimes they give me examples. My favorite one is one from I think after a docent had given some kind of a guide in a museum of science, he or she heard one of the parents saying to the children, "Now, don't believe that. It's all the work of the devil. Jesus lived among dinosaurs, and then the aliens came. They gave us fire in the wheel, and then we began to have progress."
And that probably in itself sums up why when people hear reports of UFOs, as much as you're intrigued by the prospect of ET out there, it's easy to laugh off. I have a question. If you got an invitation, if you were able to go aboard a spacecraft, no idea what lay ahead, would you do it?
If they had cable.
Rudy Linder, professor of history and astronomy at the University of Michigan, tracking the history of the UFO in Michigan. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, and keep looking up.
So, is there life beyond Earth? Well, it's a question that's been asked since the beginning of human history and one of the biggest challenges of science. But now it seems the best place to learn about this could be right here on our own planet. Scientists have begun a new research project deep underground in the Cleveland Potash Mine in the northeast of England. BBC science reporter Rebecca Morrell went to take a look.
Heading on a journey beneath the Earth. Crammed into a cage, we descend into the mine.
As you go down, you can feel the pressure increase a little bit.
How far are we going to be travelling?
We're going 1.1 kilometres, 1,100 metres, to the bottom.
The Bowlby mine is one of the deepest in Europe. And since the 1970s, potash and salt have been extracted from the ground.
OK, so, yeah, it's about a 10-minute walk, so just stay together. Don't trip over.
But the rocks here also hold something more. I'm standing in one of the many tunnels down here in the mine. There's a network of more than 1,000 kilometres of underground roads like this one. And it's pitch black, it's boiling hot and dusty. You can even taste the tang of the salt that's being extracted in the air. And it's hard to imagine that any kind of life can survive down here. Yet this place is packed full of tiny organisms who are thriving in this kind of extreme environment.
So what we've got here is salt, you can see in the bottom there, and then this saturated sodium chloride just above it. So the sorts of things that we find living in here are microbes called halophiles, salt lovers. And these are microbes that are adapted to extreme salty environments and complete darkness.
Professor Charles Cockell is from the UK Centre for Astrobiology at the University of Edinburgh. Today he's here to collect samples. Studying these, he believes, could tell us more about the potential for life in outer space.
If you look on Mars, you find table salt on the surface of that planet. If you look at Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter, you find a salty ocean beneath an icy crust. So there are salts everywhere in the universe. If you want to understand whether life might be able to originate and grow in some of these extraterrestrial environments and assess them as abodes for life, you need to come to a dark, salty environment.
It's early days, but genetic tests are already revealing that the mine harbours unusual species. And while the hope is that one day we might find intelligent, advanced extraterrestrial life, the chances are any alien species could be more like the primitive microbes found here. Professor Charles Cockell.
Is there life elsewhere in the universe is unquestionably one of the most exciting questions in science. So the search for extreme life in Bowlby is not some sort of wild, optimistic hope of finding life elsewhere. It gives us a scientific basis for understanding whether there's life in the universe, and if it is there, whether it's similar to Earth life, and if it's not, why it's not there.
That story came to us from BBC science reporter Rebecca Morell. Still to come, just what does it take to spend one whole year living at the South Pole? We'll speak with a West Michigan man who did just that and then made a film to tell his tale. That story in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Is there a shortage of skilled workers in Michigan? And now that the recession is in our rearview mirror, are there enough tool and die makers and machine operators and welders and the like to meet employer demands? Well, the answer is not a clear yes or a clear no, as Rick Hagelin discovered in his piece for MLive. It's headlined, Why Employers Have Difficulty Filling Skilled Trades Jobs. And Rick joins us now. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, Cindy.
So just to put us all on the same page, Rick, which types of skills and jobs are we talking about?
Well, they're mainly in the skilled trades areas, tool and die makers, welders, CNC machine operators. And then on the construction side, there are electricians and carpenters and plumbers, pipe fitters and that sort of thing, where the shortages appear to exist, at least when you talk to employers out there.
And one would think with Michigan's entire history that there would be a wealth of those kinds of workers available.
Well, yes, you would think so. And there probably are some that are out there still. But one of the things that happened is the past decade in the state, the economy was so bad and so many people were laid off. A lot of those people either decided, you know, I've got to do something else with my life, and they went back to school and got retrained to do something else, or they just, you know, took jobs in other areas, or they just left the state looking for work.
Sure, sure. So give us a sense, Rick Hagelin, how hard is it for employers to find those skilled workers now that the economy is recovering?
I mean, if you talk to them, they say that it's very difficult in a lot of cases. One of the things that's happened, I think, is the skills have changed fairly quickly over the past few years. And maybe somebody who was a qualified welder in 2005 doesn't know the techniques that an employer says he needs in 2013. That's a big part of it.
And as you've pointed out, apprenticeship programs are down, and I suspect employers are trying to cherry-pick the folks with more experience versus folks who are entry-level workers.
That is true. I got following that column, I got an interesting email from a welding instructor at a community college who said he was somewhat frustrated by the direction employers are going, that they're, you know, they're looking for people who have 5 or 10 years of experience, and unfortunately, they want to pay them at times for at the level of somebody who's a new hire. So he said, you know, all these people that we're training for these skilled trades positions, they come out of school and they have a hard time finding jobs because the employers want somebody with experience, and obviously, the only way you can get experience is to get a job.
There's a real disconnect there. And then you talk to economists, and they have a fairly broad streak of skepticism about this shortage, don't they?
Well, they do. I mean, they say that classic economic theory is that if there's a shortage of something, you have to pay more to get it. And employers are, on one side, are saying, well, we can't find people, but they're not paying more to get those people. And in overall, actually, the wages in Michigan have gone down in the past few years for these skilled trades positions. So the economists are saying if this was real, wages would be going up, not down.
Were you able to talk to employers and particularly kind of drilling down on this question of entry-level wages, low wages, being offered at the same time that they're demanding workers with a lot of experience?
Well, they will say a couple of things. One, they will say, well, the entry-level wage may be low, but it goes up fairly quickly. So if they get into the job and they do a good job and progress, they'll make more money. But there's also a sense that by employers that what they're paying is really a fair wage. It may not be, you know, what it was 10 years ago when there was no global competition, but they were saying, you know, the reality of things is that this is all we can pay to be globally competitive, particularly in manufacturing, and, you know, that's just sort of the way it is.
And is that not echoing something that we have been observing in the auto industry with the post-bankruptcy brave new world of the domestic automakers?
Well, it is. And in fact, you know, there's the two-tier wage structure in the auto industry right now where current workers make about $28 an hour, but anybody coming in at the entry level starts out at $14 or $15 an hour, which is much different than it used to be. It used to be all one wage level. So, you know, ultimately, the manufacturing wage overall is going to go down in future years because these entry level people will replace the older ones who are retiring at the higher wage and not get that higher wage.
And what's the message, do you believe, to the employers who say they can't fill those openings?
Some of the experts that I've talked to say that they have got to be a little bit more proactive. One of the things that they're not doing a lot of is training, they need to be more open to starting apprenticeship programs, maybe not looking for a person that really doesn't have the skills that the exact skills that they need, but somebody who can be brought up to speed fairly quickly. They've got to give a little more too.
Rick Hagelin's report on skilled trades jobs in Michigan can be found on MLive.com. Rick, always good talking with you.
Good to talk to you.
From growing up in Zeeland on Michigan's west side to cooking for scientists at the South Pole, Keith Reimings had a life that is, to say the very least, fascinating. Keith's job as a cook led him to spend a full year at an Antarctic research center, and he turned his experience into a documentary called No Horizon Anymore. Keith Reimink joins us now from Pittsburgh, where he's working these days. Keith, probably just a little warmer in Pittsburgh than when you were in the South Pole, isn't it?
It is a whole lot warmer. I spent a couple weeks just melting.
Thawing out. So
yeah, thawing out.
We all here had the very same first question, Keith Reimink. How on earth did you wind up cooking at the South Pole?
Well, I finished up film school in New York City back in 2002. And at that time in New York City, there was absolutely nothing going on with the film industry or many other industries. So I packed up and went as far away from New York as I possibly could, which was interior Alaska. I found a job in a kitchen. It was my first job in a kitchen ever. I'd never cooked before, and somebody was, had enough faith in me to hire me. And that kind of led me to, you know, keep cooking and to realize that using cooking as a skill, you can kind of go anywhere, which, you know, I think I've proven by the Alaska and South Pole trips. But I had met somebody in Alaska who worked at the South Pole, and he would spend the summer in Alaska, the summer in Antarctica, the summer in Alaska. So he would just bounce back and forth.
Wow.
And he'd work for 5 months here, and then he'd have a month or 6 weeks to travel, and then he'd go back to work in Alaska, and then had another 6 weeks to travel and go back to work in Antarctica. So it was a very alluring lifestyle, for sure, for somebody who's young and doesn't have any attachments.
So off you went. You got a lead on a job, and you wound up at the South Pole. When did you get there?
I first touched down at the South Pole, I believe it was October 17th of 2008. And I didn't leave again until early November 2009.
Boy, so you had that whole year's cycle. And just to kind of refresh our memory for those of us that are fuzzy in geography, so is it always winter? And is there a spell where flights cannot get in and out and you're basically closed in?
Sure. It is not always winter. There's a summer season. It's warm enough to fly in planes, and it's warm enough to get food. And there's a lot of people that are there working. It's the season to do all the operations that it takes to keep the South Pole going. The summer season will go from October to about early February. And then the winter season is kind of the hardcore season where the majority of people will leave the station. During our winter, we had a total of 43 people, and that was coming from a summer of 300. So we lost a lot of people. And during that time, from the February to early October, again, late October, it's just those 43 people. It's way too cold to fly anything down there. You don't get in or out. You're just stuck there. You're isolated.
And so certainly the dangers exist, and you show that. And people talk about that in your documentary, No Horizon Anymore. But I just think of the logistics, the day-to-day. For example, what kind of medical care is available at the South Pole? If someone had a hot appendix, could surgery be done there?
There's a small medical facility, and it's staffed year-round by two doctors. They were there for the summer and the wintertime, and it's a facility where you can stabilize someone. If there's a mass casualty incident, if you get hurt, you can be stabilized. Any sort of major surgeries, any sort of, you know, huge accidents, you're kind of dealing with fate. So when you go down there, you know the risks, and you make that choice personally to go forward with it or to kind of opt out of it.
Oof. Well, now talk to us, Keith Reimick, about the challenges of living with 43 people in close quarters, and there is nowhere to go. No long walks in the wood to blow off steam, no going fishing. You're there. What is that like?
I think the hardest part of that is realizing that you're there with 42 other people that you didn't choose. You know, you have no choice but to take the good and the bad. There was a lot of good. There was some bad. You know, there were people that would go out of their way to give others a hard time. But on the other side of that, there are friends that I made down there that I still talk to every single day. I can only equate it to like spending time on the moon with somebody or maybe going to war with somebody, not to trivialize that experience. Mm-hmm. But it is something that you live with these people and you work with these people and you eat with these people and you play with these people, and they are your people. And if there's an incident, if there's a problem, if something happens, they are the ones that will help you. So whether you liked somebody or not, it's a group of people that you have to rely on. And it takes a while to kind of let that sink in.
I'm speaking with Keith Reimink, who grew up in Zeeland in Michigan and wound up spending a year as a cook at an Antarctic research station. And he turned his experience into a documentary film called No Horizon Anymore. And you had graduated from NYU Film School, but you didn't plan to make a movie, although you took your camera. And did it just become too good a story not to tell?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I had taken my camera with the sole intention of recording the experience for me. You know, I'm not a writer and I'm not a very good public speaker. So my original goal with taking the camera was, well, if I just take a bunch of video, I don't have to tell people, I can show them. And what that turned into was filming every single day, talking to as many people as I could about their work and their life at the South Pole and getting as many stories as I could. And then about a year later, you know, coming off of the ice and relaxing and kind of integrating myself back into the world, looking at some of this footage and saying, wow, I could put something together that could resemble a full-length documentary. And I had no intention of having this film have the success that it's had. It's been wonderful to see people react to it and to know that they're kind of taking away something that I'm giving to them. It's a very fulfilling thing.
No Horizon Anymore, we should mention, was nominated for the Indie Spirit and Artistic Spirit Awards at the New Hope Film Festival in Pennsylvania. Keith, talk to us about the music in your film. It is exquisite.
Sure. The music comes from all local musicians from the West Michigan area. There are artists from Grand Rapids, a lot of artists from Grand Rapids, a band from Kalamazoo, and a gentleman from Holland, Michigan, who I actually went to high school with. So it's been really nice working with these local musicians, because I think that a lot of the local music scenes in cities everywhere, they kind of get overlooked. And my younger brother, Troy, who is a member of the band Ghost Heart, he contacted me quite a while ago when he saw an early version of the film. And, you know, he said that, I think this film is great. I think you have some music issues because I was using popular music. I was using music that I like, that's on my iPod, that is incredibly cost prohibitive when it comes to licensing for a film.
Yes.
And since this is my first project, I didn't really know that. I didn't understand that. And Ghost Heart has always been in the film. They've always had a song that is underneath some of the images of the sunset, which I feel are some of the most striking images of the film. And he said, well, since you have Ghost Heart here, why don't you talk to some of my friends and talk to some of the other bands that are in Grand Rapids and see if they would be willing to give you their music. And once we did that, we just got an outpouring of people that wanted to share their music. I had a hard drive full of MP3s and a desk covered with CDs. And, you know, I think there's six bands and probably 12 or 13 songs in the film. You know, I couldn't use all of them, of course, but it's a great cross-section of some of the instrumental music that's coming out of Grand Rapids and the area. You know, it's cool to be able to bring in some of the artists from my hometown, my home area. I think it's a cool way to kind of include lots of people.
Now, your documentary, No Horizon Anymore, plays around the country. How would people who want to see it be able to find you and find an opportunity to learn what life is like at the South Pole from someone who actually was there living it, didn't just swoop in with a camera? He was there living it for a year. How would we find your documentary?
Currently, the documentary is not available online. I am doing the film festival circuit till the end of the year, and when you talk to film festivals, they don't like you to have films available online. I am talking to people about distribution, but that will been toward the end of December, early January. Currently, there's at least one screening a month between now and the end of the year for No Horizon Anymore, and that ranges from a science festival in London to an Antarctic festival in Germany, to a U.S. college film festival tour on the West Coast. The biggest place that it's going to be playing coming up in September is a documentary festival called Doc Utah. That's a Southern Utah International Documentary Film Festival. And because the state is a really good place to make film connections, you know, with Sundance and Slam Dance and some other big festivals that come out of there, I'm hoping that some good stuff comes from being involved in that festival. So while I don't have any concrete information right now, there's definitely some things in the works that I will keep people posted on.
And do you have any new adventure on the horizon?
I do, actually. I'm currently in pre-production on a documentary on the Israel National Trail, which is a trail that basically cuts directly through Israel. It's a long-distance hiking trail, so you start hiking in the north and you will end in the south. And I think it's something that I've never done before, making a film and hiking, but I've made a film and I've done some long distance hiking. So there are two things that I really love doing, and I thought it would be a great idea to combine those efforts and see what could come of it.
Keith Rymick, director, producer, cinematographer, and the editor of the documentary film No Horizon Anymore, loaded with Michigan music, Michigan-made music, chronicling the year that he spent as a cook at an Antarctic research center. Keith, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And we invite you to reach out to us. What are your thoughts about what's happening in the news or people or stories around Michigan that you think we should let everyone know about? You can let us know by finding us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. On Twitter at Stateside Radio or on the website michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Sua, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.